Bangly Bang. On the Empire Podcast this week, we chat the hand of God, drugs, football, you know, all the major food groups, with Diego Maradona director Asif Kapadia.
You know, a kind of bad cop movie where they're looking for like some killer and then they go to the hotel room and they've got everything stuck up on the wall and there's arrows joining and sellotape. Yes. That's my brain.
All that and more on the movie podcast that has started training for a 10K run again and, frankly, guys, is not enjoying it. Hey, here's an idea. Instead of running 10,000 metres one time, why not run 1 meter 10,000 times? So much easier. Take that on board. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined by not one, not two, but
three
colleagues of such lethal cunning. Well, actually, technically speaking, one isn't a colleague. One is my boss. Can your boss be your colleague?
No.
Terry White, what do you think about that?
Absolutely not.
I'm going to, but we've known each other a while now.
We have.
We've become, over the years, acquaintances.
Rocky times, difficult beginnings, some may say.
Yeah.
But from landings.
From that barren ground has come the shoots of you know, friendship.
I think so. I think we went from mild dislike to...
Oh, I hated you. I mean, it was full blown. But now look at this. I'm saying to you is, can a boss and an underling ever be colleagues? Because there's always that relationship. I know that you can fire me at any time. And, you know, I will probably ignore it and come in the next day anyway. Just like George and Seinfeld.
You would so do that 8 years later. Chris still turns up to the Empire office. Empire hasn't even been publishing for the last 4 years. It's a barren wasteland.
It's just an empty room with a single desk and water dripping down. Mm-hmm. Wonderful times.
But enough about Boris Johnson becoming Tory leader.
Oh, no. Anyway, no politics in this podcast. No, hey, no. Helen O'Hara, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good. Helen, we've known each other for a long time.
Yeah.
Can colleagues be friends?
Chris, over the many years I've known you, I've come to regard you as someone I met. So that's great. I was thinking about your 10,000 times running a meter. I think that's a really good idea. But maybe if you do those 10,000 meter runs, say, on the same day... I think you could be on something.
I don't see how that would possibly work. Mm. Well, like string the 10,000 1 meter.
Yeah, like just run 1 meter and then immediately run do like 10,000 times. Meter and then another meter also and then repeat.
It's difficult.
I love how you say meter. Keep saying it.
What meter?
Meter.
Meter. Hey,
Helen
everybody.
Helen looks very sexy today and Helen says meter.
Can you say that?
In a very lovely way.
Hashtag meter. Mm. Can you say that? Can you? Yeah, that's sexual harassment, isn't it?
Helen looks beautiful today.
And
you're objectifying her.
Yeah. Don't objectify Helen, you monster.
Brains, beauty. She says meter.
Yeah.
Meter.
What is up with that?
I love it.
Where are you from again?
I don't know what's happened anyway, but I think Terry and Helen are now an item, which is lovely.
That's nice.
It's been going that way, quite frankly, let's be honest. Jimbo, that means that leaves me and you. James Dyer is also here in the podcast, which is nice, I guess. Jimbo,
hello.
We might as well pair up. Sure,
why not?
We've known each other a long time. Too long, some might say.
Absolutely, all would say.
Can colleagues ever become friends?
No.
Thanks, Jimbo. You still up for that poker game?
Yeah, sure.
All right. So it is time now for a question on the Emperor podcast. Now we've all established our friendships.
Mm-hmm.
And in Terry's case, maybe something a little bit more. I'm intrigued by this. I mean, I want to see where this develops over the podcast. Let's have a question from a reader, shall we?
Great.
Or a listener, even, because this is a podcast. at Clarky85Steve said, based on 25-year-old Justin Bieber challenging 56-year-old Tom Cruise this week to a fight. Did you see that? Basically, mm-hmm. He wants to fight Tom Cruise in an octagon.
Why?
Because
it's very unclear.
It's really hard to say, but presumably he wants to be killed by Tom Cruise, I'm guessing.
Do you remember when Uwe Boll started challenging his critics to boxing matches?
Mm. Yes.
Remember this?
Yeah.
Who did he fight? I forget. He fought a critic, didn't he?
I think he did fight a critic, but yeah. I don't remember who it was.
I don't either. I think he won because he's apparently quite good at boxing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Better at boxing, one might say, than making films, but sure.
Potentially so.
Very much so, indeed. So anyway, Steve Clark's question is, what movie star who is 31 years older than you would you challenge to a fight? Now, I thought this question was dangerous because it basically means we all have to reveal what year we were born.
Yeah, no, I don't think so.
But I did look it up, and I have to say, Tom Selleck, you are going down, my friend.
Oh, he would absolutely destroy you.
Hang on. 31 years between you and Tom Selleck.
Yeah, I know. I look older than he does. What's going on there? Only one of us could grow a moustache as well. What's happened with that?
I would have thought you were closer in age.
How dare you?
Would this fight take place around the dinner table in Blue Bloods?
No, it'd be in an octagon.
But that's not as fun. Because in this case, I think he'd enlist the help of that irritating granddad guy.
The granddad, the worst character in the history of network television.
Yeah, like he'd hit you around the head with something while you were fighting.
No, the granddad would distract me because I'd be focused so much on kicking the shit out of the granddad that Selleck would come in and just like blindside me like the Velociraptor in Jurassic Park.
Clever
Selleck. And then suddenly he's pounced upon me on the kitchen table and then it goes in a weird direction from that point on. Wow. But, you know, it's all good.
I'm definitely not going to do the maths and work out who's 31 years older than me. But I will say the best and most definitive answer to this came from Brett Spiner, a.k.a. Data, who challenged Angela Lansbury to a fight, only for Dick Van Dyke to step in and defend Angela Lansbury's honour by offering to fight on her behalf, at which point Brent Spiner backed down. At which point, Dick Van Dyke called him Brent Spineless, more like.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And Brent refused, rather politely, to make any jokes about Dick Van Dyke's name, which was probably wise. And they ended up making up. And it was beautiful. But it is genuinely the best thing that's happened on Twitter in about 5 years.
So hang on, let me get this straight. Let me just crunch the data on this. So Brent Spiner was happy to fight an 80-something-year-old woman.
I think she's actually 90.
90-something-year-old woman. But when Dick Van Dyke steps in, he turns tail and runs.
That is correct.
Cowardice.
I have
looked, Terry, you've been looking it up.
I have looked this up. Okay. Samuel L. Jackson.
You are not challenging Sam Jackson to a fight.
I mean, seriously, who would you have your money on? I think it's a really difficult thing.
I mean, you're feral.
You are wearing a beret very well right now.
Is going on with you two in this podcast?
Get a room.
She's a better match for him than people might expect. Do you know what I mean? Because he also wears a beret well.
This is a very sexual podcast.
I think
what's
happened. We're both profane. We are both, you know.
Oh, you swear at him, yeah.
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 Swear off. Okay, I challenge Samuel L. Jackson to a beret wearing swear off.
Oh, my God.
But once you get the bloodlust, you get that sort of, you
I've
know.
I've got it.
Yeah. James, I think there's a lot of compliments flowing around here today. So you are looking very
old.
I mean, you're looking at me. So well done there.
Thanks,
well done on
thanks,
that.
Chris.
Who would you fight?
Someone 31 years older than me. I'd have to say Bradley Cooper. What? Why are you laughing? I don't understand.
James was a child hire at Empire.
What year were you born?
It's like a long time ago. In a galaxy far, far away, which makes this all quite complicated.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to find you someone.
You're going to find me a person to fight.
I'm going to find you an actor to fight. All right, here we go. Here we go. You should fight Danny DeVito. Can you defeat DeVito?
Can I defeat DeVito? Possibly not. Trollfoot. I think he'd have me. He'd bite my ankles.
He'd bite your ankles. He'd, you know, quick headbutt to the balls. And
I've
be
seen
down.
Twins. He's quite scrappy.
Absolutely.
Mm. Oh, what a sight to be. I'm just like running it in my head.
Me versus Danny DeVito.
Yeah.
It's really working for me.
There's your slash fiction sort of for the next week or so, isn't it?
Wow.
He'd run between your legs and, you know, bite the nads. He'd be all up in your grill.
He'd go full penguin.
He'd topple you like Gulliver.
Then he'd climb all over.
Yeah.
Okay.
He'd romance your stone.
Weird.
He'd kick you in the jewel of the Nile. That's for sure. So there you go. Danny DeVito fighting James Dyer in the car park of Morrison's next week.
Anytime.
Get your tickets.
I'm going to head over there now.
Anytime.
I'll cut you, Danny. I'll cut you.
You're going to kick him out of a window.
And
there we go.
What's the word for that? Remember, we learned at the live podcast?
Defenestrate.
Oh, yes. Mm.
Wait, I was letting Terry. It was,
sorry, Terry.
You stole her moment.
Defenestrate. That's how you say it, right?
Well done, Terry. Well done.
You should have heard the
positive
shit
reinforcement.
I got on the Pilot TV podcast last week for using the term iambic pentameter, which I then had to explain.
No, I'm sorry. It wasn't the fucking words iambic pentameter. It was you being a bellend and talking about iambic pentameter on a TV podcast. That was the problem.
I mean, that's
I can
fair.
See.
That's
this is a recurring theme here. Yeah. By the way, if you're a screenwriter and you're listening, the character name Bic Pentameter is a great one because you can have a character come in and go, I am Bic Pentameter. See?
That's good.
So
that's
there
amazing.
You go. So if you're writing a Shakespeare-related comedy, have one of your characters be called Bic Pentameter. A guy comes in and goes, I am Big Pentameter. Let's have a party. Because that's what he says. That's his catchphrase.
Wow. Okay.
Hey, Big Pentameter. If you want to have your question read out in the Emperor podcast, as Steve Clark found to his cost, you can get in touch via a number of methods. We're on Twitter as at Emperor Magazine. Use the hashtag Emperor Podcast. Don't look at me. Or you can Facebook us as well, where we're Emperor Magazine. Or you can email us podcast@empireonline.com. Use the subject heading Big Pentameter, or chances are we won't see it. Anyway, should we move on to this week's movie news?
Please.
Oh, let's. Can we talk about that TV news as well?
I mean, well, if we must. I believe there is some sort of podcast that is already existing that will take care of that.
I've heard that. Tell me about it, Chris.
What was it called? The Basic Bingers. It was really good, guys. You should check it out. No, it's the Pilot TV podcast, James. And my understanding is that it's available every week and it features you, Terry White, my boss / colleague / friend, Boyd Hilton, one of my favourite journalists named after a hotel chain.
Right. Well, it sounds very good. It sounds essential, even.
Yeah, along with Steve Travelodge. And, of course, Brian Premier
Inn. Omni.
Yeah, all good. So that's available every Monday.
I'll give you some fucking news. So there's a Dune TV series.
Right.
Denis Villeneuve, the legend that he is, has announced that he's going to be involved in a spin-off TV series about the Bene Gesserit sisterhood.
Oh, mm-hmm. God.
Oh, yes.
This is potentially very cool.
Yeah, it is cool. It is cool.
Yeah,
allow James to de-cool it now by Dune-splaining.
No, Helen, you Dune-splain. I think everyone's heard me do it enough.
So this is the sisterhood of, you know, think nuns, but kind of Machiavellian and a lot more like James Bond.
And a little
right?
into eugenics.
Yeah, very into eugenics, but on a particular scale. So they are working towards creating a particular future and making sure particular people are born at particular times, and they use every tool at their disposal, including their own reproductive organs, to make sure that that happens. Mm-hmm. Except, of course, when they choose not to and everything goes a bit squishy with the God Emperor of Dune and everything else.
Indeed.
But yeah, so they're literally manipulating the fate of the universe
By having sex with people.
Sometimes by having sex with people, sometimes by killing people, sometimes by all sorts of different means.
Fear the Gom Jabbar, Helen.
You have just described the Conservative Party.
No, but they're very competent, the Bene Gesserit, and they know what's happening and they plan. So really
not. Oh, no, you have not described the Conservative Party.
So okay. It's very, very different.
Sorry, no politics.
Indeed. My only concern about this is an entirely female sisterhood, and there are no women currently announced in the production team, which is a little bit concerning. You know, you've got Villeneuve in charge, and he's great, but at the same time, like, a little bit more female input might be
It's called
a good
Dune
thing.
The Sisterhood, and yet the sisterhood is not involved.
Exactly. Yes. That's my thing.
So my understanding is that Rebecca Ferguson's Lady Jessica,
that's right, mm-hmm.
is one of the Bene Gesserit.
Indeed.
Yes, indeed.
So do
but
we
she's,
think
she's the one who kind of screws things up by having a son when she's told to have a daughter?
Paul Atreides,
mm-hmm. yes,
played
that's right.
by Timothy Chalamet,
aka Muad'Dib.
I'm on board with this. Now, do we think that Rebecca Ferguson is going to turn up in this television program as well?
I wouldn't
given
expect
that she's a bona fide movie star.
I wouldn't expect her to play a major role, but we know the Mother Superior casting, right, from the film, which was?
It's Charlotte Rampling.
Charlotte Rampling. So I imagine Charlotte Rampling would play more of a role, but it could well be that it's a particular offshoot of Sisters on a particular mission that we see, so that might not be the case.
Who knows? Or dares to dream.
Indeed.
Dune, the Sisterhood of the Travelling Pants, will be coming to a streaming service soon.
But this is cool, right? I mean, let's actually drill into this a little bit deeper, because this is what they wanted to do with the Dark Tower initially before they fucked that up completely. Mm. Where they had initially announced when Ron Howard was going to be director, as it was going to be three movies with two TV shows to bridge those movies, and that Javier Bardem would actually be in those TV shows as well as Roland Deschain before he moved on and Ron Howard moved on and it all went terribly, terribly wrong. And it's also Netflix this week have announced that they have a showrunner on their grand plans for the Narnia series as well, the Chronicles of Narnia series, and it is the co-writer of Coco, Matthew Aldrich, and he's going to come on and oversee the whole thing, and that's going to be TV shows, films leading into each other, a whole interconnecting narrative. Do you think this is the future in a weird way? And also the fact that Villeneuve is directing this is interesting to me. He's not just doing the film or films and then just passing it off to some Dune dude to do the
junior
TV show.
Duner.
A junior Duner. So he's doing it himself, and I think that's
for the first episode.
Yeah. But he's also, and then he'll be locking down the visual template for what follows.
Well, yeah, I mean, and obviously Marvel are doing it with their Disney Plus shows as well, which are much more, I think, closely tied to the universe than what we've seen from them before. So yeah, it does seem like it's a brave new dawn, a way to get your cinema audience to watch your TV shows and vice versa, I think is a big part of it as well. And also to use the characters that you have that aren't quite cinematic enough maybe for the big, big, big screen.
But I think that's what they've got to work out, right? Because I think I see the benefit for streaming and for TV. You've got somebody like Villeneuve who, as you say, can set the whole template and can make sure that the quality when it moves over to there is as high as cinema. Because as we know from some of the Marvel shows, what they lacked was the same quality as the cinematic universe. I suppose for me, it's really working out what still belongs on a cinema screen and what belongs on a TV screen. Because while people are, you know, we talk about this a lot on Empire and Pilot, while people are moving between those things far easier, people are consuming them with much more parity, they are still different experiences, and there are still things that are far more suited to paying your 15 quid and going to see them big in scale and scope and in an epic way on a cinema screen, and then something slightly different on TV. So I think you still need some kind of differentiation between the two so that people understand why they're watching it, where they're watching it as well.
Yeah, I agree with that. But this sounds potentially intriguing. I would just, you know, given that it is an order entirely of women, I would like to see some more women in there.
Oh, you'll get your... Honestly.
No,
now
ridiculous.
You do sound like the Conservative Party. No, no, wait, no, you don't. You really don't sound like the Conservative Party. Yeah, very, very excited about that. And there was also some video game adaptation news this week or over the course of the last week as well. The Division, Tom Clancy's The Division, which James can probably bore us to tears about.
I could, but I won't.
It's going to become a movie on Netflix with Jake Gyllenhaal and Jessica Chastain attached. And David Leitch going to be directing it as well. Netflix have snapped it up, which kind of surprised me that no major studio would go near that property with that caliber of talent attached. That's exciting. What is that exciting, Jimbo?
I mean, if it involves them running around areas, killing brainless AI soldiers in a never-ending grind for better loot, then yes, I'm sure
you're not
a
fan of the game.
The game bored me rigid. I haven't played The Division 2 because The Division 1 made me lose the will to live. But it's a particular genre of game, so which requires great investments of time for, in many ways, little or no reward. So I'm not a fan.
Okay, so let me play devil's advocate here. My theory for a long time has been that you can make a great movie based on a video game if you don't make a video game first. If you pay no attention to any video game in particular. Like Crank is a great video game movie, it's just not based on a video game. So maybe if they just ignore the video game, apart from maybe the title, then it could work.
It's just a name recognition thing, isn't it? Because there's no real need to base it on The Division, because it's a slightly sort of miscellaneous future, post-apocalyptic kind of landscape. You don't need to base it on anything.
That's what I'm saying.
So do that.
Do that, indeed. And also, the Uncharted movie is creeping ever closer. It has now got a date, and that date is December 18th, 2020. And this one's going to star Tom Holland, the noted historian.
Oh, I love him.
Who is going to step up the plate and play young...
Wait, is it definitely that Tom Holland?
Hang on, let me just take a quick look here. No, sorry, got it wrong. Yeah. Tom Holland, the director of Child's Play and Fright Night, is going to step up the plate and play a young Nathan Drake, which is a bit of...
That's a stretch. Are you sure that's...
No.
Is it the other one?
It's the other one.
Oh, okay.
It's the footballer. No. The guy who fixed James' roof. No. Tom Holland, the guy who plays Spider-Man, is going to be a young Nathan Drake in the Uncharted movie, which is out December 18th, 2020, directed by Dan Trachtenberg, director of 10 Cloverfield Lane. Now, you won't be surprised to know, I haven't played this game, but my understanding, Jimbo, is that Nathan Drake is a really grizzled Indiana Jones type in his 40s or so. So this is clearly going to be a prequel.
I don't want to see little Tom Holland playing young Nathan Drake. I want to see Nathan Fillion playing older Nathan Drake, for that is what was ordained and that is what we deserve.
Here's the thing. Nathan Fillion is cliched, boring casting for that role.
He's excellent casting.
Only
he's
because people have been
casting.
Telling you he's the right casting for 20 years.
Kyle motherfucking Chandler.
Oh, he's handsome.
Only because he looks a little bit like him. That's, no, but that's also your only ground.
He's got it going on. He's got the manliness.
He's got the stubble.
He does, you know, clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose. But he's not really Nathan Drake for me.
He's not quite as roguish.
Yeah.
He can be roguish, though. I thought he was pretty good in Godzilla, King of the Monsters.
He wasn't roguish there.
He wasn't roguish, but he was pissed off.
Good.
He was solid. Absolutely solid.
Did he play Mothra?
Someone told us this week that the house he is in at the beginning of Godzilla King of the Monsters is also Tony Stark's house in Avengers Endgame. Mm. And Helen, you found this out, didn't you?
That you can rent it on Airbnb.
Can you really?
$800 a night. I think we should all go.
How much was it before it was in Avengers
Endgame?
Probably
like $100 a night.
$800 a night.
Oh. I'm thinking live show. I'm thinking us four, producer Jane, select audience, real select, crowdfunded. You have to pay for our flights and accommodation as well, guys, and obviously the stuff. But if we can raise, just do the numbers here, crunch, $500,000 between now and the end of July, I think we can make this a reality. And then we can bang on about Avengers Endgame some more because we haven't done that enough.
We haven't really discussed that. We should talk about the portals.
We should talk about the portals. Portals. But yeah, Kyle Chandler, he's right there, guys. Nathan Drake. Kyle Chandler is one of those guys who should be a much bigger star than he is.
Agreed.
And here's my thing. A few weeks ago, people were poo-pooing me whenever I was raising the idea of Nick Holt playing Superman. Now it's all people can talk about. Mm. I walk into the building, I can hear people going, Nick Holt, he'd be a great Superman. And I think the same thing is going to happen with Kyle Chandler as Nathan Drake. Terry's on board.
I agree. The same thing will absolutely happen as what happened when you suggested Nick Holt for Superman.
Nothing. Yes. Stony silence.
Absolutely nothing.
All right. Any other news? Terry, do you have any news?
Yes, I do. I want to talk about Mindy Kaling and Ms. Marvel.
Woo!
James looks really excited already. So Mindy Kaling, she's obviously in promotion for Late Night and was talking specifically about Ms. Marvel and the Kamala Khan incarnation. So there's obviously been four in the comic book series, two of which were Carol Danvers, two of which were Kamala. And Ms. Marvel, I know, has been in kind of production at Marvel on and off for maybe the best part of a decade. So when we did the Captain Marvel story earlier this year, they talked about how there had been various Ms. Marvels in development. This is obviously a very specific one, the first Muslim hero. And Kaling basically said, she rang Marvel and said, I really, really would like to do it and I will be involved in whatever way it takes to make this happen. And said that essentially they sounded very receptive. Mm. What that means in terms of actually getting it into development, I do not know.
I call them up all the time and they just never answer. Or,
in fairness, I got the impression they came to her and then she made the offer of doing anything basically to make this happen. But maybe I'm misreading that.
One of us is, maybe me.
But no, it's film. The comics are so popular. These sell way more than your Doctor Strange's and your Guardians of the Galaxy. And she's just a phenomenal character. She's really good. She's as bouncy and young and excited as Spider-Man, but she has a whole other raft of issues and questions in her life. Different, very, very different powers. She's had some really cool, funny storylines. She hung out with a teenage Loki, it's a long story, for a while, which was really funny. But like, she's got a different set of problems and a different set of challenges, and I think she'd be great. And I know that, you know, Mindy Kaling was speculating about the Disney Plus service and the streaming service.
Yeah, could be a place for it.
I want her on the big screen. I genuinely don't want them to be scared of this because she, the comics are so good and so big that I think they have a real opportunity here to put her on the big screen in the same way that they made Doctor Strange into a thing, in the same way that they made Guardians of the Galaxy into a thing. Ms. Marvel should be a big screen thing, and I really want to see that.
It could be a really important part of the next phase. And there's I don't see any natural reason it would go on Disney Plus. I mean, unless they really wanted a piece of hero content to give it some kind of big marketing at the get-go. Mm. But I think it's absolutely should like be all a cinematic Disney property.
Yeah, all the Disney Plus stuff. And Kevin Feige this week revealed the first kind of behind the scenes or first piece of concept art, from from the Loki show, which had a marquee for Jaws in the background. So it does look like Loki's going to be bumbling his way through human history, as indeed has been said before. So that's going to be interesting. But all that stuff's been kind of spinning off from the bigger franchises. And that's just one that I'm missing. I don't think I am, but it's like Loki, WandaVision, Falcon and Winter Soldier, Scarlet Witch. We've already mentioned that one. And Hawkeye's going to get his own show as well. So I'm not sure they're going to, well, maybe they will debut some new characters on the Disney Plus service. But Kamala Khan is a great way to go. She's a very good playable character on Marvel Puzzle Quest.
Oh,
three stars. Very good. She can attack the other team all at once. And when she does so, your team gets an energy boost as well. So that's a good character.
Please.
A little tip there.
Please play Marvel Puzzle Quest. Do not play Marvel Puzzle Quest. Chris is addicted to it and it's deeply upsetting.
I am looking to join a new alliance.
Oh my God.
By the way, I left my alliance this week.
Is that like a guild in World of Warcraft?
Anyone wants to have me join their alliance on Marvel Puzzle Quest and hit me up. My username on the game is Pod Empire. That is My username.
It's not though, is it?
It is really. It's Pod Empire. So check me out.
Is that like Dungeons and Dragons?
No.
It's like Candy Crush with Marvel characters.
James just described the best thing ever, right? The only way this game could possibly get any better is if Jurgen Klopp ended up somehow as a playable character or non-playable. Wow. In this game, I'd be very, very happy. Hey, do you know that Black Adam has got a director? That's exciting,
ooh,
isn't
who's
it?
Who's that?
Well, Helen, I will tell you. Thank you for asking. It is Chame Coletzera, who, of course, is the director of... he's working with Dwayne Johnson on Jungle Cruise. And Black Adam, in case you don't know what that is, this is possibly the longest in development movie in the DCEU. It's been in development long before, I think, any of the movies that they've made in the last few years. And this is... Black Adam is the arch nemesis and mirror image of Shazam.
Mm-hmm.
But he can't actually Google any song to find out what he's listening to. I think one of the power he's lacking. And this was mooted long before the Shazam movie was in development. I think they were kind of seeing how that one went. But now it looks like they are going to hit with Black Adam because Chame Coletzera, who has directed Dwayne Johnson on Jungle Cruise, which is out next year, is looking like he's going to direct this movie as well. Director also of four movies with Liam Neeson. Can you name them?
The flight plan? not flight plan. In flight. There was a red eye. I don't know.
Non-stop. Okay.
Non-stop.
Okay. Number one. Okay.
They're all about transport.
No, they're not all about transport.
Was that the commuter?
What's the one in the
trailer? Commuter.
The one where he played the commuter? What's that one? The commuter? Okay, that's two. Okay.
Any of the Takens?
No.
No.
One is from a few years ago. It was the one where Big Liam kind of loses his mind a little bit. He has amnesia.
Diane Kruger in it.
Correct, yes. Okay. Unknown, which has had an amazing scene where Big Liam and Aidan Quinn. You can't do this.
No, I'm looking up to see what the last one is. I'm not going to give it away.
And then the last one came out a few years ago.
Yes, I found it.
Big Liam and my good friend Joel Kinnaman. They're running all night.
Run all night.
Run all night.
That's the one. That's the one. So there we go. So Chame Coletzera, a decent pair of hands. Director, of course, also of Goal 2, Living the Dream.
So yeah, but good. Fine. I mean, The Rock has been attached to this forever. So let's just do it and move on with our lives, you know?
Yes, absolutely.
It might be great.
I believe.
A couple of quick things before we move on.
Sure.
Spice Girls are back.
Are they?
They're playing Wembley Stadium tonight.
Wow. It's such a shame.
Time of recording.
Going to be somewhere else.
They're back. They're touring. There's only four of them touring, but they're back in a new animated movie that Paramount Animation is going to make, and all five are going to be involved.
Mm.
So Posh, Baby, that's Scary, exciting. Spicy, Dozy, Deaky, Bicky, Mick and Titch, Bim.
Spice Girls. It's funny because that was the working title of the Dune spin-off series.
Hey!
Interesting that Victoria the Posh is involved because she's refused to pretty much do anything.
So who is not involved? Is it the ginger one?
No, pay attention.
She literally just explained.
So she won't do
I wasn't listening.
Apparently the tour is the saddest thing on earth because it's the remaining four of them half-heartedly singing along to their songs. Posh / the Victoria did not want to be involved in any new Spice Girls activity because she is a multimillionaire and has her own fashion line and is a very serious fashion person.
And perhaps not the best singer. So perhaps it's not suited.
If that's going to be the rule, then
sorry, hang on a second here. Mel C is a belting singer.
Fair play.
All right, she's got a range of at least an octave.
Sporty can hold a tune. So actually, Victoria being involved somehow has become a weird kind of indicator of quality. I think potentially
gives it that extra quarter inch, to quote her book. So great.
What?
I'm sorry, what?
No, it's the name of her book. She's written a book. She's never read a book, but she has written a book.
She said that.
I'm okay to say that.
Oh, I thought she's gone full Garth Marenghi.
No,
I am one of the few people you will meet who has written more books than he's read.
But yeah, she called her book something like that, Extra Quarter Inch, which is about just the perfection in fashion and just going for that little extra thing.
That's weirdly what my autobiography is called as well.
Okay. All right, Hedwig.
The Doctor Sleep trailer dropped.
Ooh.
This is exciting. I've yet to see it, in fact, because it has dropped while we've been in here recording this podcast. But apparently it is in many ways the successor of the Stanley Kubrick movie, which I had not seen coming. I mean, I perhaps should have done.
Shining sequel to Shining, shocker.
No, but sequel to Kubrickian Shining, which obviously distinguishes itself heavily from Kingian Shining. And yes. King is involved in this film, and King famously hates the Kubrick film. So it's interesting that they are straddling these two worlds like a great big axe-wielding colossus.
True. It does seem to be as much a sequel to the Kubrick film as the King book. You're absolutely right.
Whereas we were really expecting
not what the book is necessarily.
A sequel to Ready Player One, and that would have been more in keeping.
Oh, boy.
I'm really excited about this. I haven't seen the trailer yet, but in Mike Flanagan, I trust. And I think this could be absolutely blinding. So, there we go. And then just two really, really quick bits. Kevin Hart is in the market to remake Scrooged.
Well, look, I mean, every generation gets their Christmas Carol. Unfortunately, the last one got the Robert Zemeckis animated film, which wasn't great. But even though my inclination is, no, don't touch Scrooged, it's perfect.
Is it though?
I mean, it's pretty close. Yeah, it's pretty great. But I just feel like maybe I should be generous and allow someone else to consider the possibility of maybe remaking it, even though it's perfect.
I think this would be a good role for Kevin Hart.
I think he could do great things with it, actually. Yeah, but also, like,
there's
just so many good bits in that are just pure Bill Murray, and, you know.
It is the most Murray of Murray.
It's very Murray.
Yes, I love Scrooge. It's a glorious film.
And then very, very quickly, finally, before we talk about the most important movie news of the week, obviously, Steven Spielberg is going to write something for... Jeffrey Katzenberg is launching this new... I can't get my head around what it is or where it's available, but it's called... Or even how you pronounce it, but it's called Quibi or Quibi.
Quibi?
See, that's the thing. Like, pick a word that people know how to pronounce, Jeffrey. You think you would know that. It's an abbreviation of Quick Bites. So it's now Quibi, Q-I-B-I. So Quibi, 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 anyway, whatever it is.
Queer Eye for the Strike? I don't know.
Lots of famous people are going to be writing stuff and directing stuff and producing stuff for this platform. So Paul Feig is attached to develop shows for this platform. I assume people will be able to watch on their phone. Don Cheadle is attached to a show as well. The news has emerged this week. But Steven Spielberg is going to write a series of horror shorts for this.
Cool.
Which is very, very cool because he hasn't written anything since 2001 with AI, artificial intelligence, but before that was really Close Encounters and Poltergeist as well. So exciting stuff. And apparently these are going to be short chapters, 10 to 12 short chapters, 7 to 10 minutes each. Spielberg's written 6 thus far. A bit busy at the moment on West Side Story, and then he's got Indy 5 to do as well. But you can only watch them after dark, apparently.
Yeah, so I don't get this right, because it says your phone registers that the sun has set, and that's when you are able to unlock the content and watch it.
Yeah.
But you must be able to circumvent that, right?
Can't yeah, you
I
can.
Just put my head under the my quilt?
Well, no,
cover?
it won't be light sensitive. It'll basically work on, it'll know when dusk is in the time zone that you're in.
Yeah. You must be able to.
Of course,
like,
yeah. You just presumably you can change the clock on your phone. Yeah.
Yeah. Whenever I used to play one of the Star Wars games on my phone and your lives replenished over time, you would just go in, just change your phone. Or was it Candy Crush? It was Candy Crush.
Oh, my God.
And you would just change the clock on your phone, and then it would think it was like 8 hours later, and so all your lives had replenished. And I should try this for Marvel Puzzle
Quest. You have too much free time.
Oh my God, why?
How do you switch off the weekends, Terry? What do you do? What do you do, Terry?
Watch insanely grim and violent television shows or films.
Brilliant. Super good.
It's a right laugh around mine if anyone wants to come.
Hey, speaking of insanely violent, can we talk about Quentin Tarantino?
We can.
Because he talked this week to us, in fact, about his plans for Star Trek and an R-rated, sweary Star Trek. And I have to say, I'm trying to digest this, and I'm having a little bit of trouble. So obviously, we've had swearing in Star Trek, most notably recently in Discovery.
Mm-hmm.
They've even dialed it back there because they kind of did it, and it was a bit like, this feels weird.
Yeah.
And I feel like they've kind of...
Set phases to motherfucking stunt. All right, steady.
Yeah.
Steady.
It's a bit
to boldly
like,
go where no motherfucker has gone before.
And I just don't know if we need it. And I'm trying to be open-minded to the possibility of a very different kind of Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't want
it. You mean a good one that's
like
entertaining?
No,
I'm kidding. I love the story. I was just being controversial.
I watched DS9 this week and it's still so freaking good. But I'm trying to be open to this possibility of an R-rated, sweary Star Trek, and I don't want it. And I'm trying to want it, and I don't want it. But he's Quentin Tarantino, and I'm assuming it'll be good, and I'm wrong and everything else. So I just wish he'd stop and not do that.
James, I'm curious as to how you feel.
Oh,
about
I'm
a massive geek.
You cannot have too much Star Trek. Everyone should be making Star Trek. I want a channel that's just fucking Star Trek.
And you're fine with. You've just proven my point.
Yeah.
By
but the thing is,
you want fucking
Terry,
Star Trek.
I love swearing. I love Star Trek. What's not to love about putting these two great things together in one glorious concoction?
Because it's not very Star Trek.
Like, of course it is. Kirk swore.
Fucking
like,
Earl Grey.
Look, I know.
Motherfucking hot.
I mean,
in Encounter at Farpoint, like, Picard drops a meld right there in
the first
episode.
He
like,
melds.
I know this. But I feel like it shouldn't be your intention. It shouldn't be like, it feels more like Quentin Tarantino imposing himself on Star Trek. And maybe that's completely unfair and wrong, and I hope to be proven unfair and wrong in this, but it feels weird to me, and I don't feel like we need that in Star Trek.
Well, I think what Discovery has shown us recently is there's more flex in Star Trek, I think, than maybe we thought. Because like traditional Star Trek had a very distinct warm and fuzziness to it, and I think and there's something comforting about that. And I've always worried about moving away from that.
As Discovery went on, I think it brought more and more of that back, and I think more and more of that worked. I felt like it moved away from the swearing actually, and it moved towards relationships.
I'm fascinated by this because, you know, Tarantino has said repeatedly that he's going to make 10 films as a director. Mm-hmm. I mean, technically, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is his 10th film, because if you split Kill Bill into two films. Anyway, it's a whole can of worms. But the next film after this will be his 10th and final film if he sticks to his word. And frankly, I don't think he will, but you never know. Because why box yourself in?
He will. He's
why
Tarantino.
Box yourself in like that? What if he makes his 10th film?
No, he's going to stick Tarantino.
He's
going to
Soderbergh all over the place. Yeah. Like, unretire.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Oh, God, what a brilliant use of Soderbergh all over the place. You know what he's like, though. What's he like? It's classic Tarantino to go, I'm only going to make 10 films and then be bloody minded and make.
But why
just
do
10
that
films?
To yourself? Like, what if he makes his 10th film and then one day he's walking along and he gets an amazing idea for his 11th film and it's burning him up inside and he can't do it because he said what he said? Just go and make it, Quentin. No one's counting except you.
What he could do
and
is
you.
Make a.
And me.
Single film, arguably, and break it into, or make 8 films and put it all together in one film. A la, you know, Death Proof, Kill Bill, you make multi parts.
Don't run a 10K once.
Exactly.
Run a meter 10,000 times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
So Tarantino makes one film, that's like 10 films.
Well, I'm on board with this. I think it's good. And I want to know what they call a quarter pounder with cheese on SETI Alpha 5. So, you know, roll it on.
Well, it depends if you've got your universal translator switched on.
It switches you from imperial to metric.
Of course.
Roll it on.
Hey, so
Roll it on, Terry. Engage. Make it so.
So if I'm correct, this Tarantino news came out of an esteemed publication that was published this week, right?
Total Film.
Yeah, I believe
it
was.
I was just going to make that joke. Yes, Helen, thank you.
Segway.
The new issue of Empire came out today. Woo. We are recording this on Thursday. And Tarantino and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is the cover. Our beautiful, lovely, smart... excellent, funny Nick Desemlian went in the edit with Tarantino. Also spoke to Brad Pitt, spoke to Margot Robbie, spoke to Leonardo DiCaprio. We have the full incredible story of the making of this film. Also, Tarantino is our Empire 30 director this issue. So we put your reader questions to him and he tackled them gamely. And also we have Robert Rodriguez and Kevin Smith giving us their tribute to the filmmaker. It is, I have to say... a fucking amazing issue. We've got Ari Aster in there.
For Midsommar, right?
Yep. We went to New York and hung out with him. We've got Jim Jarmusch for The Dead Don't Die.
Love it.
I think it's pretty much the only interview he did at Cannes with our Alex Godfrey. We have Agnes Varda. Obviously, her final film is due out just a few months after she died. And we tracked down lots of her closest collaborators to talk about her spirit and her verve and her filmmaking brilliance. And this issue comes with Pilot.
Yes, enough about the magazine that comes free with Pilot TV magazine. Let's talk about the main event.
And we went on set of Stranger Things for the third series.
Strangest Things.
And we have James Dyer's epic.
Yes.
Biblical.
Yes.
Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, yes. Oh, my God. It's the best thing in the issue.
It's so good.
And we have the best of summer shows. So it is, I have to say, I know like I get paid to say this, but also it genuinely is the best, most compelling, exciting, exclusive packed package of Empire and Pilot. And it is now on newsstands pretty much everywhere.
Hooray!
All good and evil news agents, and digitally as well. It is an absolute belter.
What was your favourite bit, Chris?
I interviewed Jim Mangold. That was nice. And obviously my section, the award-winning, mainly awards I bestowed upon it myself, the award-winning review is, Terry, it's a belter, isn't it?
You did speak to Guillermo as well.
I did speak to Guillermo del Toro and all sorts of stuff. There's great things. Now, Ron Perlman is in there. Sam Elliott, Helen, you spoke to him.
Yeah, I did.
Fantastic.
Or you heard his voice rumble out of the speaker.
It was
there was this
almost indistinguishable sexy rumble just coming through the phone. And then occasionally like a phrase would sort of float to the surface.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, point is, it's a great magazine and you should pick them up immediately at a newsagent. Empire and Pilot.
Hurrah.
What a team. And speaking of great magazines, it is time to have a word from this week's sponsor. Because we're always delighted to have The Economist sponsor the podcast, and this week is no exception. And if you don't already subscribe to The Economist, well, friends, I'm here to tell you that you are missing out big time. The Economist is your one-stop shop, your indispensable guide to economics, politics, entertainment, and the world around us, and it has been so for over 170 years. Yes, I looked it up today. I Googled this. The very first issue of The Economist went on sale in September 1843. Wait a minute, that's 6:45. Oh no, the year 1843. But it remains as vital and essential as it ever was. And you know, I like to flick through the current edition, in this case dated June 8th, 2019, looking for stories that have a filmic bent, and few are more filmic or relevant than the story of Tony Medina, a prisoner on death row in Texas, who has spent the last 2 decades in solitary confinement and whose plight is profiled in an excellent article. And it's relevant because it's heavily reminiscent, we didn't talk about this in the news section actually, of the tale of Albert Woodfox, who's a man who was kept in solitary confinement in a Louisiana prison, I'm not kidding, for 40 years before he was released in 2016. And Solitary is the name of the book he subsequently wrote about his struggle to survive on the inside and the outside, because psychologists say that it can bring with it extreme emotional and psychological trauma once you get released. This week it was announced as a major movie to be produced by and star Mahershala Ali. So it's relevant in that way, and the story of Medina is an increasingly timely one as the demands on the prison system in the United States and concerns about the number of prisoners in solitary confinement grow. And whatever your position on the penal system, it's an eye-opening read. And it's just one of the many brilliant articles in this week's Economist, articles that will expand your mind to give you brand new insight into the way the world works. And we're once again offering all UK-based Empire Podcast listeners an incredible free offer, a free print copy of The Economist to share amongst yourselves. Oh, no, wait, no, sorry, I read that wrong. There's one each. You get one each, one free print copy each to get the ball rolling. How much will it cost? I don't think you guys were listening. It's free, gratis. No money will change hands. All you have to do is text the word movies to 78070. And before you know it, you'll be up to your eyeballs in great articles. That word again, movies. The number again, 78070. And thanks once again to The Economist for sponsoring the show. All right, so now it is time for this week's guest. Asif Kapadia is one of our finest directors, and he's able to flit nicely between feature-length narrative movies like The Warrior, his first movie, and Alienina, which came out recently. But also he has carved out this new career for himself almost as a documentarian, almost by accident. He made Senna a few years ago, obviously the story of Ayrton Senna. Then he followed it up more recently with Amy.
Amazing.
The story of the late, great, tragic Amy Winehouse. And now this week he completes a trilogy of sorts with Diego Maradona, which focuses on a very specific time in the tumultuous life of, well, Diego Maradona, one of the greatest footballers of all time. Asif Kapadia popped into this very, very booth last week and I had a good old natter with him about, well, lots of stuff. Football, yes, obviously. Films, yes. Liverpool Football Club, yes, we're both supporters. Did we start there? Yes. Was he in Madrid at the Champions League final? Also, yes. But once you get past that stuff, this is a really fascinating interview. So do please enjoy Up the Reds. Delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the director of Diego Maradona, Asif Kapadia. How are you, sir?
I'm good, man. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for being here, especially since you had a fairly lengthy journey. You were in Madrid on Saturday night. So What's your experience been like?
So to get to Madrid, I was in London doing press. I went to Milan to Bari. There was a festival going on in Bari where they were showing Amy. And then I went from Bari to Rome, nearly missed my connecting flight, which landed after my flight to Madrid was taken off. Got to Madrid, found a place to stay, was there for the game. The game was awful, but it doesn't matter because we won. And then on the way home, there was no plane and no pilot for some reason. And we had to drive to Valencia. And I came home via Valencia. So that was just a typical weekend in the life of a Liverpool fan stroke film director.
Yeah, I imagine.
And the weekend before I was in Cannes. It was just mad.
Yeah.
It's been absolutely insane.
So have you had time to touch the ground yet? Have you had time to decompress?
Well, yeah, because as soon as you get on a tube, you're back. You know, uh-huh. So as soon as you wake up and you're back on the street, it's like, did any of this happen? Was it all a dream? And I felt a bit like that this morning, actually. But also, we're in Camden. So this place brings back a lot of memories because, you know, I used to live around here, did a lot of work around here. The Amy story is all set around
It's all around here, yeah.
All these streets, you know, it's in the film, it's in the footage. So just coming back here brings back a lot of memories as well.
Just very, very quickly before we talk about the film, I have to ask you about Saturday night as a fellow Red, as a fellow massive Red, someone who had a ticket, someone who was in the ground. I'm not jealous, Asif. I'm totally and utterly fine with you being there.
You can touch me if you want.
I was in Istanbul. Should we call it a draw?
Look, I mean, that's pretty incredible to have been there. But I was in Kiev. Were you in Kiev? I suffered. For me, this is all part of the payback of suffering so much, of being there and seeing that way that we lost last year, traveling and watching your team and being at a final and then losing and then finally getting one where we score in the first minute. And it's so odd to be ahead and actually kind of feel like we're not in trouble. We've been here. They've learnt. They're experienced. They know how to slow the game down. Lost the league by a point. And then we're in a Champions League final and we win it. And I don't think we were ever really in trouble.
And the calmness. It's the calmness of the football this year. The calmness under pretty much any situation.
And they didn't run out of energy 60 minutes in.
Yeah.
That's the difference. They were like getting late goals. So I think the football's changed. The players have matured. And that all just comes from experience of being in a final, losing, coming back. The whole squad doesn't start all over again from scratch. They're young. They're growing together. He's so good at putting together a team. Mm. He is the man. I mean, that's the biggest thing for me. Best signing we've had 30 years. It's Jurgen Klopp. He is so brilliant, so lovable. And you know every other team wished they had him. It's been great talking to you. We should do this again.
It's been fun, hasn't it? We should probably talk about the film.
What film?
Oh, what's it called? Diego Maradona.
Oh,
that's the one.
Film. Yeah,
that's the
good film.
But it is interesting. I mean, do you watch football with a filmmaker's eye? Do you watch it with a documentarian's eye?
I watch football with a football fan's eye.
Because otherwise it wouldn't be fun, right?
What I didn't know, all those summers that I spent in my teens, growing up on the sofa watching sport, who knew? Out of that, two feature films will have come out. Senna. I watched a lot of Formula One growing up. And watching football. Who knew this could be a career choice? It was never the plan. It was never the idea. Tour de France, I still haven't done. I watched a lot of Tour de France from beginning to end, thinking this is an amazing cinematic sport.
There are no interesting stories in the Tour de France.
Greg LeMond. Do you know anything about the Tour de France? Greg LeMond, after racing for a month for 3,000 kilometres, he won by 8 seconds. Against Laurent Fignon. It's a great story.
That's interesting.
One day.
Because football on the big screen has been something of a holy grail. And Diego Maradona isn't necessarily a football film. It's about a footballer. But there's a lot of football in the movie.
I can't think of many good football films.
If I'm honest, you're being generous if you say something like Escape to Victory.
Oh, that's not very good.
It's not very good.
No.
And otherwise, what else do we have?
Ipswich are good then. There are not that many.
So it is a really tough nut to crack.
Mm. Team sports generally, but that football particularly.
Yeah. Was that uppermost in your mind when you started to take this challenge on, or was it Maradona?
I was aware of it.
Yeah.
No, I was aware of it, but I wasn't thinking. I mean, it's character, you know. Yeah. My job is to find really interesting characters. So Ayrton Senna was an amazing character. It wasn't because I thought, oh, it's really important to do something about Formula One. He happened to express himself via a car.
Mm.
And the challenge there was, no one cares about Formula One. How can you make that interesting? People who don't care about cars going round and round in circles. Well, you find the right character, you can care about anything. You can be emotionally engaged by someone who's wearing a helmet, driving 200 miles an hour. Amy was a different thing where she was a Londoner. She was a local girl. I remember thinking she was really fascinating because I just never understood why she was in such a bad way and still performing.
Mm.
Maradona kind of pre-existed those films because I'm a football fan, and I remember him in the 82 World Cup. I remember hearing this guy was meant to be the best player in the world. And then when he played, it was a bit of a disaster. And Argentina, at that point, you know, we had the idea that Argentina played dirty football in the 80s and he got sent off and he wasn't really all that. And we all loved Brazil in the 80s. So 82, I just remember Brazil, Zico, all of that.
Yeah.
86 comes around and he is undisputed. He is the best player in the world. He did everything on his own, took an average team, won the World Cup. And so when this project came around, I had read a book in the late 90s when I was a student, which was about Diego's life. And that book, I remember just thinking, wow, what a life. The things that he's done off the pitch are incredible. Wouldn't it be great one day to make a film about him? So that idea came from a book that I read in like 1998 or 1999.
Wow. One of the things that struck me watching the film, I watched it last night, is the sheer amount of incredible footage that you've got, incredibly candid footage. Where did you get that? Where did you procure that footage from? And how do you even begin to assemble that into a narrative?
I read this book in 1989, and then around 2012, around the time of the London Olympics, a producer called Paul Martin contacted me.
Yeah.
He'd seen Senna, liked Senna, and he said, look, I think I've heard there's this material that's part of Diego Maradona's private archive.
Okay.
That's somewhere outside of Naples. I think I can get access to it. Would you be interested in making a film about him? And I saw a little bit, like a YouTube clip, of about 10 minutes of footage. And for me, at that point, it was just like the wrong time. I've just done a film about a Brazilian sporting hero. I don't know if I can go straight into an Argentinian sporting hero. So it went away. But this idea was still kind of in the back of my mind. And then it was after we made Amy, and after Amy had kind of gone through awards season, when my producer, James Garis, and this other producer, Paul Martin, went off and accessed the footage. And they came back and said, look, what they said was hundreds of hours of footage that was shot about Diego. Later on, when I investigated, what happened was Diego, when he was younger, around the time he was at Boca Juniors, 1981, mm-hmm. he had his first agent. He was a mate of his called Jorge Sista Spila. Now, if you're interested in football, you should know about this mm-hmm. guy. He is probably the world's first super agent. Mm-hmm. He took Diego, they were schoolmates, you know, kind of not schoolmates, but mates when they were at school. And he was slightly more educated and came from a more middle-class background. And Diego was like a street guy from a favela, essentially. And he did him a deal to get him his first professional contract with Argentinos Juniors. He got him to Boca Juniors. He did the biggest deal ever to get him to Barcelona. And he broke that deal to get him to Napoli. You never heard of this guy, but he only had one client, Diego Maradona. And he also had the foresight to say, this kid is a star and we should make a movie about him. He should be big in America. He should be big all over the world. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to hire two cameramen to just follow Diego Maradona around. On the pitch, off the pitch, have access all areas. This is before clubs worried about media content. So these guys could be on the standing, on the side of the pitch, behind the goal, filming, but specifically just filming Diego. Now, this is in a time when, if you thought about Italian football in the mid-80s, it was one big, wide, high-angle shot from the top of the, you know, the worst version of what you saw in the UEFA Cup just now with Arsenal and Chelsea. That's all you got, right? That was how you watch football. And the reason we've got this amazing access is because these two cameramen were only filming Diego. But his film was never made. It started in 1981 and it was incomplete. And in a way, we finished it in 2019. So we managed to get a deal with Diego and his lawyers and a deal with the cameraman. Half the footage was somewhere outside of Naples. The other half, I later learned, was being kept by his ex-wife, Claudia, in a trunk in Buenos Aires.
Okay.
She and Diego are not getting along well. Let's just say that's an understatement. They're suing each other right now in America. I'm still going to get that material somehow. I've got to talk to you, Claudia. You've got to give me an interview. I know you're not getting along well, but you are a part of this story. We've got to talk to you. I did an interview with her, and then I said, can I just see what have you got in the back room? She's got all of his shirts, trophies, everything. And there was a trunk that hadn't been open for 30 years, and in it were a bunch of U-matic tapes, this old video format from the 80s. And on those tapes are the footage, the stuff when he arrives at the stadium in the car, walks out like Gladiator, going into all of that was on these tapes that were disintegrating. And I said to Claudia, look, we're going to digitize this material for you because you're going to lose it. It's all going to be lost to history. Even if you don't give me the footage, I'm just going to digitize it. So at least there's a copy of it. And then hopefully you'll trust me long, you know, enough to do a deal so we can interview you and get a copy of that material. And eventually it took a year.
Yeah.
But we were able to do it.
That's incredible. And that's the starting point. The film itself has quite a narrow focus. As you say, it has the World Cup, both World Cups, the 86 World Cup and the 90 World Cup are part of it. And you focus very much on a specific period of his career, which is mainly the Napoli part of his career. Was that something that you knew going in that you wanted to do, or did you find that along the way?
No, I really always cast the net as wide as possible. So we did research everything from when he was a kid, his family, his background, 78 World Cup, which was, you know, height of military dictatorship. There's a lot of corruption that's going on, a lot of stories, a lot of awful stories about what was going on during the 78 World Cup. And the point is, Diego's, even at that age, 17, 18, they're considering him in Argentina the best player in the world. Mm. He doesn't even get selected.
Yeah.
So he's like a failure. In the 82 World Cup, he plays, he gets sent off against Brazil for a terrible foul in the groin region of a Brazilian player. Red card, misses the rest of the tournament. They get knocked out. So all of that was in a long cut. We always have these really long versions. But in the end, it was just too much. Diego's story is huge, goes on forever, continues to this day. He's doing something right now that could be in a movie. So you just got to pick your choices. You know, I wanted to make a movie that was a couple of hours long for the cinema. I didn't want to do it as a series. I felt it was a bit of a trilogy of movies made about these kind of amazing child geniuses, but made for the cinema. Senna, Amy, and then Diego. So we had to pick, what's the heart of the story? What's the biggest cycle of his life? And the place where he became the best player in the world and the place where all of his problems started, where he became a person suffering from addiction issues, all happened in Naples. The most dramatic period of his life and the place where, I guess, the best footage that we had access to, that we could visualize, therefore make a movie, was all during Naples.
And growing up, I remember watching Maradona, obviously in the World Cup, and now and again you'd see him on the TV, but TV football was never televised to the extent it is these days. So this film was incredible. Just seeing this guy, this artist at the peak of his powers, the things he could do with the ball, the movement, the way he would jink pass players. Every tackle in this movie that he seems to ride is a career-ending tackle if it connects. It was mind-blowing. The unreconstructed thuggery of the football back then was extraordinary to me. What was it like for you watching and finding that stuff?
I absolutely agree. I think that's the shocking thing is when you see how brutal football was in the 80s, and he's in Italy where he had the toughest defences and the toughest... And yeah, he everyone's trying to break his legs. And so this idea that everyone gets a bit obsessed with the fact that he might have touched the ball with his hand or not touched the ball, I really don't care. The defenders are trying to kill him. And he's saying, you are cheating and I'm going to do whatever I can do to get my own back to you. And I think that's what's interesting about it. Because if you are a real football fan, you know, if your player falls over and gets a penalty and he wasn't touched, you're not going to complain, right? But if at the time, the way football was so brutal, he did have an injury in Barcelona where his career could have ended before anyone even heard of him, really, before he'd become famous, because Goycochea did break his ankle.
Yeah.
You know, that's where he had to come back from. That's just our title sequence in our film.
Yeah.
So it was happening all the time. And I agree, you know, it's the fact that football was brutal. It's the fact that the pitches were in a real state. The balls were different. And the big thing is, in those days, you wouldn't even get a foul if someone smashed into you and knocked you over. Now you get a little touch, you know you're going to get a free kick.
Yeah.
Players roll around, they get a free kick. It's possible to score 50 goals every year this year because no one can touch you.
Yeah.
In Diego Maradona's time, the toughest league there's ever been, because all the best players in the world were in one league playing for all the teams. He goes to a team that was nearly relegated the year before and within 3 years wins the league championship. In the toughest league with the best players in the world spread around, that just doesn't happen. Now players will only go to the richest team in every league. They're only going to go to a place where they're guaranteed to be in the Champions League.
Pretty much, yeah.
You know, it's different. It's different. And during that time, Argentinian journalists would say to me, Messi's great, but what Messi will never do, he will never beat England with like what is one of the best goals of all time and a handball 4 years after they were at war. That's the thing. He, you know, after the Falklands War, they played in a quarterfinal.
Yeah.
And everyone says if you were to sum up his career, that's the match.
Yeah.
It's not the final. It's not the semi-final. Yeah. It's the quarterfinal against England, a team that humiliated them in a war. He then beat in the way that Latins want to win a game.
Yeah.
You want to beat them with genius, but you also want to beat them with a bit of cheating because that hurts more. That's why everyone's still going on about it.
It strikes me that the film, you very much have this notion of the duality of Diego. I think that's why there's even a line dividing Diego and Maradona in the title font. Was that something that you went into this film knowing that there was a duality to him?
I tell you what you'll learn when you talk to me is that I have no idea what I'm doing when I go in.
Right. I mean,
this case, I actually had read a book, which is a first with Senna and with Amy. I didn't go away and read loads of books to research them. What I do is I just start talking to people and I start looking at the footage, and the story always comes out of what I see and what I hear. So I don't go in there with any kind of idea, preset idea. So here, I didn't have any idea what the drama was going to be. I knew that there's a lot of events in his life. I know he got into a lot of tricky situations. And it's literally during the interviews when I'm talking to people, things start being said and I start making connections and links. And I'm in my mind, these films, the process is always like, you know, a kind of bad cop movie where they're looking for like some killer. And then they go to the hotel room and they've got everything stuck up on the wall and there's arrows joining and sellotape. That's my brain when I'm making these films. So I'm just getting bits of paper and I'm sticking up on the wall and I'm trying to make a connection between that bit and that bit and that bit and that bit. In my second, third, fourth language, because I don't speak Argentinian Spanish and I definitely don't speak Neapolitan. But Fernando Signorini, who was Diego's trainer, personal trainer, who brings him back from that leg break and says, yeah, the way I'm going to train you, because you're brilliant already, I'm going to train your mind. Read this book. Read this. I'm going to teach you about this. I'm going to teach you about that. And for you to understand where you stand and what you mean culturally to Argentina and to people and to Neapolitan. Really interesting. So it was Fernando Signorini, who I'd never heard of. But when you talk to him, you realize he knew everything about Diego, and he knows Diego Maradona better than Diego knows Diego Maradona. He came up with these ideas. There's Diego and there's, you know, Maradona. There's one guy that's really sweet, really nice, really lovely. I want to spend all my time with him. Then there's this other person, the ego almost, the kind of angry version, which is Maradona, who I wouldn't take a step with. Mm. But a Maradona being so smart says, yeah, that's cool. But if I was just Diego, I'd still be in the shanty town.
Yeah.
It's Maradona that got me out of there.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. That's what I thought was interesting. And the film's sort of built on this concept of you need these two sides of your personality, your schizophrenic, bipolar, whatever it is. He has these two sides. And once you understand that, if you see Diego Maradona doing anything afterwards, it kind of makes sense. Because I can meet him on one day and he's lovely. And I meet him the next day. It's the same guy. Nothing's happened between us. And you can just see he's in a bad frame of mind. And what did I do? You didn't do anything.
Yeah, of course.
He's just not the same person today. And the people I met would say they wish he could go back to that guy he used to be. So it's almost like you've got this spectrum with Diego on one end and Maradona on the other. And he somewhere swings between his two ends. Now, when I asked him about it, he would deny it totally. He's like, there's only one of me. What are you talking about? But he's everyone around him kind of got the concept and agreed. And maybe it's a bit simplistic, but when you're making a movie, you have to kind of come up with the essence of how you can express this idea.
Yeah.
What was evident, he was never forced into a situation. Mm. It was not like he had an entourage that made him do things.
Mm.
No one could make him do anything he doesn't want to do. I'm never going to get him to go to Cannes unless he wants to be in Cannes. And last year, during the World Cup, you know, that great reputable newspaper, the Daily Mail, somehow came out with this idea that I had told him to act up during the World Cup.
Oh my God.
Because it was for a film. He decided to
box
act
office.
Like, I'm going to make him do anything. That's him.
And of course, with both Senna and Amy, in a horrible way, you had something to hang your movie on as well, which was tragedy and a full stop to both their stories.
That was a conscious decision. I knew that if I was going to do this again, it had to be different to those films. I couldn't make a film which, you know, sadly, tragically, the two wonderful human beings died young. So I was aware. That's one thing I knew, that the reason to do this, one, he's alive. Mm-hmm. I can meet him and talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whatever that changes when you've got the real person around. And then the other thing is his story keeps going. He keeps creating drama, and it's going to be a difficult way, one to end, because this is actually about growing up and getting old and dealing with or not dealing with the mistakes you've made in the past.
Mm.
And I guess I'm making it now as an older person than when I made Senna and Amy. So I thought, yeah, that was a challenge that I was interested with, and because it's not, you know, they're, like I said, they're tragic endings, but it's not a neat ending here. And his biographers and journalists that I met, one of my questions would always be, so where does this film end? And they just start laughing. They're like, good luck. You know, we've written books about him. And the minute we press send and sent it to the publisher, he'd go off and do something tomorrow that makes the whole ending irrelevant. So they were just laughing, saying, good luck.
Do you have Google alerts if he does something daft?
Kind of, yeah. You know, I mean, not for that. But yeah, you do hear about
it. Maradona.
If you don't hear about it, someone tells you. Have you seen what he said? Oh, no. What's now? One of them was when we were trying to show him the film. I was hoping we'd be nearly done. Actually, we're a year away from finishing. But I was thinking, it's time to show him the film. Because I had three interviews with Diego. That was a contractual situation. 3 times 3 hours. And I'd used up 2 of them. And I was saving one up because I wanted to show him the film. I figure there may be certain things in there he may have an issue with, or may say, you've got that wrong. It was like this. I'm like, okay, I'm going to show you the film. It also may, you might remember things differently.
Yeah,
having
watched
that material of himself that he's probably never seen.
Yeah.
You know, he's never sat down and watched those U-matic tapes that I have. So I was going to show him the film in his living room in Dubai and then interview him. And then his people said, well, he's not going to be in Dubai. All right, where's he going to go? He's off to Belarus. So I can get the map out. Where's Belarus? Oh, right, it's closer than Dubai. Can we come to Belarus? They said, no, he's off to Colombia. Colombia, I don't think I can go to Colombia. Any other time we can show you the film? Well, I'll be in Moscow for the World Cup. Why don't you come to Moscow? And I was like, I don't think that's going to be a good idea. And as we saw, it wasn't going to be the best time to show him this particular film.
I can imagine.
They also said, just send us a link. I'm like, I think I need to watch it with you.
Yeah.
So then it was like, where are you going to be after Moscow? He said, I'm going to be in Argentina. So he's like, okay, fine. We're flying to Argentina. I've still got a few interviews to do. We booked our tickets 2 days before we fly to Argentina. I'm packing my bag. I get a message from my mate in Puerto Rico saying, have you seen the news? I'm like, no, what's up? He's taken a job in Mexico in Sinaloa, which is where he's been for the last year.
Oh, my God. So
he still owes me an interview.
Yeah, I was going to say. So he still hasn't seen the film.
No.
He still owes you an interview.
Yes.
Is there a sequel coming? But
being in Diego Maradona land, so we were worried about the trailer and what's in the trailer and how's he going to react when the trailer comes out. Fine. Okay. Then the poster comes out and we didn't even think about it, but on the poster it has four words. The title, Diego Maradona, underneath it says, Rebel, Hero, Hustler, God. So some Argentinian journalists went up to Diego and said, have you seen a poster? And he said, yeah, it looks great. He goes, yeah, but look what they've called you. And they translated, however, this person, who's never seen the film either, translated hustler into Spanish to Diego. Diego took great offence. The day after Cannes comes out and said, I do not like this film. I don't agree with that word. I'm not a thief. I never stole from anyone. That's one of his go-to lines, by the way. If you've ever looked him up, he will always say, I never stole from anyone. I worked for a living. And he says, do not see this film. And it was like, there's a kind of slight panic with all the distributors, like you can imagine, in Cannes. I'm like, he hasn't seen the movie. He's talking about a word that's been translated to him. But what it is all the Argentinians. I said, everyone's going to want to see the film the minute. Because there was this kind of understanding that when we said we got this archive, that somehow the film was the official version.
Yes.
But if you've seen the film,
yes,
it's kind of all in there. Everything that he did is in there, you know.
And it doesn't hold back.
The fact that none of his team had seen it, how could they have given us notes? No one's watched it.
One day.
One day we'll sit down and watch it.
And get that extra 3 hours.
I did have the feeling in Cannes of going up the red carpet and, you know, it's an incredible experience. But when you're there, I was just thinking, God, what a shame Diego Maradona's not here to experience this love coming from the audience. And from it would have been amazing for him to have been there. Halfway through the film, I was thinking, thank God he's not. I'm like, oh, God, this is great. Who had the idea of showing it to him for the first time in Cannes, of all the crazy places in the world? Then at the ending, we got a standing ovation. Like, oh, what a shame he's not here. But I was thinking, I don't know if I would be here if he was sat next to me, if he was watching it for the first time in front of 2,000 people in that cinema. So it's all part of it.
And had he been there for the first time, he might not have been around for the standing ovation. He might have left before then, stormed out in a rage.
Something would have happened.
Something would have happened. You would have had a Google alert, but you wouldn't have had to have
I would have been a Google alert.
I would have been a Google alert. Over the last few years, I mean, and right from the beginning of your career, but especially with the last few years, beginning with Senna, you have juggled directing documentaries, but also directing TV and directing narrative features as well. How do you balance those two different sides of your career, or do you not see it as two different sides of your career?
I mean, it is, because I really love shooting. So it's really fun to be back on set and doing kind of Mindhunter for David Fincher. It was amazing. But it's partly to keep my sanity, because it's not healthy to be editing for years on end. It really isn't. It's a weird way to make movies. So to go away from that, back to what was always my first love, which is being on a set with a crew, shooting, actors, having a script, worrying about schedules and time and, you know, getting it all done. So I had a great time doing Mindhunter. I did another film, Alienina. I've done a bunch of stuff like that. I really want to write a script. I want to go back to, like, my first film, The Warrior, and find a story and find a book and adapt it and lock myself away and write. And there may be docs that I produce, or maybe other stuff that I do. If I do a doc, I probably won't be doing a biog.
Uh-huh.
I'm feeling it's time to deal with the state of the world we're in, something political, something to do with the environment. There's a book that I had an option on that I was working on. I'm not sure if it's going to happen, but in my head, Senna's an action movie.
Uh-huh.
Amy's a musical.
Uh-huh.
Senna's a low-life gangster film. It's like, you know, it's Mean Streets or something. So I think the next one I'd quite like to do a sci-fi, but my version of it.
That would be very, very interesting. I know exactly what you mean. The beginning of this movie feels like something out of the, you know, out of an 80s thriller.
The ending, yeah,
oh, of course, yeah, absolutely. Fall from Grace. Perhaps our paths will cross at Anfield next year. Asa Kapadia, it's been a pleasure.
Inshallah. God willing.
Thank you.
Thanks, man.
Thank you. All right, so that was Asif Kapadia. Terry White, tell us about this movie, Diego Maradona, starring Diego Maradona as Diego Maradona.
It is. The cast is not extensive for this one, Chris. As you said, this is Asif Kapadia's third film in something of a trilogy, which began with Senna, and then we had Amy, both, I think, revolutionary in terms of documentary filmmaking. This is slightly different, I have to say, in terms of how he used footage. There is a lot and lot and lot of footage. And you're right, it really pivots narratively around the kind of insane mania around him when he was at the height of his fame. So it opens on this kind of set piece of this car racing through the streets with screaming fans, and it's this mad chase.
Yeah.
And you get the sense of him being in the middle of this frenzy that you really only see for like musicians and rock stars.
It's like a thriller.
It is like thriller. And it's really about, much like Amy, it's really about the price of success and the price of fame and the human cost of that. The thing is that this is a really well-known story, and he is, we should say, the only subject who was still living when the film is made. So, and it covers, you know, women, drugs, fame, kind of despair. The bit that for me was kind of missing a little bit was they had new interviews with Maradona, and they didn't really reveal very much. So I was really waiting for kind of this moment of self-awareness around the price of fame, the awful drug years, the things he's been through, and having the sense of perspective to be able to look back on what's gone.
I don't think he thinks that way, though.
Do you think that's what it was?
I think that's what it is.
I wasn't sure if he was just still so in that place of dealing with shit.
Yeah.
That he'd not reached the end of it to be able to kind of look back.
It is interesting, though, because I, you know, you could argue certainly a part of him dies in this movie. And, you know, there's a really interesting thread in the film. We discussed it a little bit with Asif in the interview, where he kind of stumbled upon this idea of this dichotomy between this relationship between Diego, who is the sweet, loving kid who grew up in Argentina and just happened to be, you know, quite possibly the most talented player to ever play the game. And Maradona, who is the persona he creates, and gradually I think that persona takes over and subsumes Diego. And you could argue that the events of this movie, which again are fairly well documented, but I don't want to talk too deeply about them, that perhaps Diego no longer really exists, that it's all Maradona, it's all his ego monster. And that ego monster would look back at this period and think, well, I didn't do anything wrong. I was the victim of circumstance. I was the victim of a conspiracy. So maybe there's something in that. Maybe he doesn't, maybe he has moments of genuine regret, but I don't know whether he would actually express them in a public forum.
No, and I think what I missed was learning more about him as a man. But to what you're just saying, actually, if that private, real, if that's what we want to call him, part of him has not existed in that way for a long time, then maybe it was never going to show you that. Do you know what I mean? Because they spoke to his ex-wife, they spoke to people in his life, and there was never, for me, real meat on the bones of Diego Maradona, the man, as opposed to Maradona, the footballing icon. But actually, what you've just said is really fascinating, because maybe that's the reveal. That he is now just Maradona.
Yeah.
And what went before is what led to him. Because, you know, he looked, the most devastating bit, and without saying too much, but the devastating bit is when you see him now, really.
Then also you get that sense of the pressure ratcheting up in him. And,
yes,
you know, he chose in a way to live in this goldfish bowl but got himself into this situation that he just couldn't extricate himself from. And it's... from that point of view, it's a tragedy as well. I thought it was fantastic myself.
And I have to say, the filmmaking craft is something else. Kapadia, I mean, his editing skills are phenomenal, and we knew this from Senna and Amy. The pace and the rhythm, the narrative rhythm he puts in just through sheer intelligence of editing is absolutely phenomenal. And maybe part of what I'm getting at, and I have to say, I reviewed this and I still reviewed it really positively, is that I'm not a sports fan. And so the over-reliance I felt a little bit on game footage really kind of left me feeling a little bit unsatisfied on the narrative side of it.
Okay.
But I mean, these are quibbles because it is a brilliant, brilliant piece of filmmaking. And if you have any interest in him, the sportsman, or of that period, of that, you know, that particular time in sport, in that the kind of 80s and that decade of excess and what was happening culturally with drugs and all of that, you can see how these things all came together into being the kind of perfect storm for what happened to him.
Absolutely. It's a fascinating one. And, you know, this may be a bit of a glib comparison, but in the way that Kapadia made the film kind of reminded me in a way of how writers put features together in a weird way. Yeah, we're not obviously comparing ourselves in any way, shape or form to what Asif does, but he went in, he had no idea of the story he was going to tell until he went in and found this hundreds, thousands of hours of footage, and then gradually, you know, and began to find something. Oh, here's a line here. Oh, that'll spin me off in this direction. And that's very much the way I work when I'm writing the feature. I'm sure it's the same with you guys as well. But, you know, so it's an interesting, just a creative process that went into this movie, fascinated me also. But I thought it was terrific and a very worthy successor, I thought, to Amy and Senna.
Yeah.
So, 4 stars then for Diego Maradona, and now we move on to Men in Black International, and that obviously, don't know why obviously, but it means that James Dyer is here to talk about it. Hello, James.
Hi. Yes, they let me review a comedy, which, as we can all agree, was a really good idea.
Who let Dougal do a funeral?
Exactly that. This is Men in Black 4, coming a full 7 years after Men in Black 3, and shed of both Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones, replaced instead by Tessa Thompson and Thor himself, Chris Hemsworth. In fact, not only does it reunite Hemsworth with his Thor Ragnarok co-star, it also reunites him with his Thor Ragnarok accent, because he's playing a Brit agent at the London Men in Black office. And Tessa Thompson is a rookie agent who gets seconded to London to, I mean, honestly, it doesn't matter. There's a bunch of stuff. There's an alien that gets killed. There's a weapon. The plot is completely disposable. But they're really good fun. And I, freakishly, found this film funny. I laughed in it. You're all shaking your heads at me. This is the most hilarious thing. Like, I should never be allowed to review comedies because I hate all comedy and I find nothing funny. And yet we came out of this and I'm the only one who found it amusing.
When did you laugh?
I was
sitting 2 seats away from you.
I laugh on the inside. But I found it funny. Like, I chortled.
Internally. Which
bits
did you?
With the Chris Hemsworth being funny, the bits with Tessa Thompson being funny.
I'm going to focus in on this. So I'm going
to do it. Hit me with it.
Which bits were Chris Hemsworth being funny?
Because you could argue
that Chris Hemsworth, who's a very, very funny man,
he is,
and brilliant, is not so in this film.
No, I disagree. I felt this film, and I said this in my review, it feels a little bit like a gag reel for Thor Ragnarok. I think it's those two, though. I think he and she...
You wash your mouth out. You take those words out of your mouth.
He and she have an incredible chemistry. I think they spark off each other. I think they're really funny. I think Kumail Nanjiani was really funny as Pawnee in this
as well.
I think Rafe Spall was brilliant as kind of the sort of sneery thing.
How low is your bar?
I had so much fun with this film. So that's why I gave it the full 5 stars. So... No, I kid. This just about scraped a 3. But nevertheless, for Men in Black International, that's pretty fucking impressive, because this was a film I think we'd all written off as terrible.
And some of us continue to write it off, having seen it.
This to be absolute shit. I thought this would be the most disposable film of the summer. And yet, I had loads of fun.
Their chemistry of fun. Is non-existent. And Hemsworth, who I think is so charismatic, he's so naturally compelling.
Funny.
There's a phone here. I'm going to use it to dial something in. Like, really?
Oh, that's harsh. He was in full, like, Thor.
He strikes me in this movie. He's brilliant. He can improvise with the best.
Yes, loads of improv.
But it didn't work in this movie. And he strikes me as someone who was slightly left adrift without a really good script. F. Gary Gray.
Definitely a bad script. Definitely
it's weird to say these words, but F. Gary Gray, who has made a lot of films I like, is not a comedy director. He doesn't have the lightness of touch.
But equally, from an action point
of
view,
he is not Barry Sonnenfeld.
It doesn't really, like, he does. You never saw, I think, any of his Fast and Furious flair. Like, there's a chase sequence in this, and I thought his Fast and Furious chops were not on display in that. I thought that chase sequence. In fact, the action set pieces as a whole are quite disposable. And yet, I really enjoyed the company of the characters and the jokes were amusing.
Who are you, and what have you done with James Dyer?
That's a fair
question. I know.
Question.
I came out of this and I was like, I don't understand how I've become the kind of sole defender of this comedy.
I laughed three times. The funniest thing that happened when I was watching this movie was something Helen did that I cannot repeat.
No, you can't.
While the movie was coming to an end.
Helen laughed four times in this film.
I did laugh occasionally.
You chuckled the camera. Yeah, yep. I was... Yep. It's but seriously, the movie is so unfunny. I was counting the number of times I laughed, James. What is wrong with you?
It's 140 minutes. It's a little longer than
it needs to be.
It's a
little long.
Because Sonnenfeld's films were around the 90-minute mark. Like, he was quite...
Because he understands that comedy gets less funny the longer you go over 90 minutes.
And yet, I didn't get bored.
Okay, but I was super bored throughout.
I think I might have been the only person in this entire room who enjoyed it. But
there is something. I'm trying to work out what it is where the person who hates comedy really likes this. And the people who like comedy don't like it.
Yeah.
And there's a weird inverse universe thing happening here, which means it's definitely not funny.
We're
if
in
you
the
like
upside
it.
Down.
I think that would explain a lot.
I don't know what happened. It's possible I've had my memory erased
there's
or something.
There's some interesting ideas in here, but and the plot is super predictable. If you can't see what's going on from about minute five, then there's something wrong with you.
It has none of the absurdity of the Sonnenfeld movies. And let's talk about this franchise very quickly in terms of when we say Men in Black, we really mean Men in Black.
We
don't mean Men in Black 2,
in
which
black,
is not good.
2 is terrible.
Men in Black 3
is
worse than that, and this continues the downward trend.
Mm. Except that it's the second best Men in Black film.
It's your
no, but I mean,
your,
I actually wouldn't
to idiocy.
I actually wouldn't argue with that, but like.
I
think the other two are terrible.
Yeah.
So I like even if I call it the second best, it's still not good.
I love the way I am officially the champion for this film, and I'm basically saying it just about scrapes 3 stars.
you sound so enthusiastic.
It's because I was so surprised. I had this as a nailed on somewhere between a 1 and a 2. Like this looked like the trailer's terrible. The idea of it, like who the fuck wants another Men in Black movie? And it doesn't even have the stars in it, you know. And I was like, oh, it's Chris Hemsworth. He's playing an English guy. So this is just a car crash waiting to happen. And then I went in. And I was like, oh. This is
but
fun.
The characters are weird and unlikable. Hemsworth is unlikable in this movie.
Yeah, I think he's likable in the same way that Ragnarok and indeed Fat Thor in Avengers Endgame is likable. I love that shtick that he does. I think it's really funny.
Thor's likable in this movie because it's Thor and we've built up this relationship with him over the years and Hemsworth's fantastic in his roles. And
yeah, he's
this
he's,
was Thor
a
in a suit for me.
No,
that's all I
dick.
Needed.
He's acting like really entitled, annoying, full of himself.
Like some kind of
idiot,
entitled, annoying, like a vain, boy.
No, but that's the thing.
They cussed him out.
Thor is never annoying. This is the interesting thing. Whereas this guy is annoying.
I think H&M is excellent. And
H&M is a fantastic clothing shop, sure, but I'm not sure what that has to do with it.
Agents H&M.
I see.
No. See what I did there?
Oh!
Yeah, I was riffing
on
the store.
I hadn't put that two together because I was trying so hard to look for the exit while this movie was playing. I don't... The chemistry that they had, and they had chemistry off the bloody chain, off the charts even, in Thor Ragnarok. Just non-existent here. You wouldn't even know that they'd made a previous film together, Tessa Thompson and Chris Hemsworth.
I disagree.
Well,
I think she's really trying to do something with the character as well, but I don't think she has anything to work with in the script.
I think the script is
I don't think there was a script.
Yeah, that's the fundamental problem,
It's the improv that works. Yeah.
But actually, I think one of the big problems is that Men in Black had a spirit and a knowing kind of sense about it, which meant it was really, the tone of it, was what made it really funny. This, for me, took itself so earnestly in places, and I was, but like, took their attempts at humour really seriously. And I was like, that spirit and that playfulness and that knowing sense of what they're doing was just completely redundant.
See, I got the complete opposite. I felt like this leaned into the goofy far more than the previous films had because
but
you didn't have
I'm
a strength.
About, I'm like, there's a difference between knowing and leaning into the goofy, whatever that means.
Anyway, so Ed Solomon, Helen's just drawn my attention towards this. Ed Solomon, the co-writer, I think, of the first one, or maybe he wrote the first one on his own, said, in honor of the release of Men in Black International, brackets, I guess, I just got my new Men in Black profit statement, which shows it's still in the red. The fact they've made a fourth one confirms, as I've always said, that the big studios are only in it for the art. And clearly that art won over James Dyer, and we gave it 3 stars. 3 stars we officially
a low
for Men
three.
In Black.
A low 3. A generous 3.
Which brings us on to the last film this week, Sometimes, Always, Never, which, I mean, this is a movie about Scrabble, Helen, isn't it?
It is not a movie about Scrabble.
Okay.
Yes, in a manner of speaking, it's a movie, in fact, about Scrabble. But it's also a movie about a family and a father and son relationship. So it stars Bill Nighy as Alan, and we meet Alan going on a journey with his son, Peter, who's played by Sam Riley. We're not quite clear why they're going where they're going at first. They stay overnight in a little hotel where they meet another couple who are played by Tim McInerney and Jenny Agutter.
Oh, great. Good casting. I like that.
Casting already.
Yep.
And again, you're not quite sure why they are there, and I almost don't want to explain it because I feel like the less you know, the better. But cool. They all play a friendly game of Scrabble, and it's essentially a story about this relationship between the father and the son. There's a missing part of this family. There's a fragment missing from the family, and it's sort of messed them up, and it's messed up their relationship. And soon after this particular evening, Alan essentially invites himself to stay with Peter and his wife, who's played by Alice Lowe, and their son, mm-hmm. Jack, and starts trying to kind of, I guess, maybe reconnect or build something new with them in this kind of new world that they're all living in. And it's about that. It's about these relationships. So when this film sticks with their relationships, I think it's actually really good. It's written by Frank Cottrell Boyce, who's done...
he's fantastic.
Yeah, great, great. And really moving British films before this. The Railway Man. What else did he do? Did one of Danny Boyle's Millions. Things like that. He's a really good writer. I think that's all there. The director is Carl Hunter, who has written... You know, he's done quite a lot of work before in short films and TV shows. I'm not sure if he's done many films before.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he kind of goes for kind of Wes Anderson-esque quirkiness, you know, sort of close-ups and odd angles of objects that are pretty looking and weird, almost not quite stop-motion animation, but weird sort of angles on things, and there are little bits of animation and things like that, and it just doesn't need it. And I wish he'd kind of just trusted in his script and his cast, both of whom are fantastic, to just tell the story, because I always felt every time one of these moments happens, it kind of threw me out. And there are elements of the script being kind of mannered and intentionally odd. But when you add in the kind of odd way of filming as well, it divorces you from the story instead of drawing you in any way. So I just find it really pointless in that respect. Those kind of flourishes. But apart from that, I really did like the characters. I really did like the story. I think the less you know about the story going in, the better. So I wouldn't even read too much about it. But I just think he needs to trust himself as a director, because the family scenes and that stuff is actually really, really good. And I just don't think it needs the frippery around the edges.
Sounds intriguing. And we gave this one 3 stars, which, as we always say in the podcast, is a recommendation. 3 stars then for Sometimes, Always, Never. But is it a recommendation about Men in Black International?
Yeah.
This is what I really want to know.
It
is from James.
Yes, it's comedy gold.
3 stars.
I know now why you laugh. Here's
I'm
going to
go out on a limb
do.
And say, if you are skin and on the fence, do not pay to see this film.
Yeah, but like ultimately, this summer, what are your options for, like, if you want blockbuster entertainment? It's like Godzilla, Dark Phoenix, Men in Black.
You speak as a man who does not pay to see movies.
That's also
theater.
True.
Stuff that happens in the park.
Yeah. I'm going to see that's Shakespeare.
That's Shakespeare. What?
Theater.
You mean Big Pantameter?
Yes.
He's back.
I'm going to see him in Midsummer Night's Dream today.
That's the one with the ass.
It is.
Is that why you're dressed all sexy like?
Maybe.
Ah, it all makes sense now.
All right. Interesting. Very interesting indeed. So 2 stars in for Men in Black International.
Unbelievable.
What else can you do? You can see the Women's World Cup. That's going on right now.
Is that
now.
Football?
Yes, it is football.
I don't know.
It's a Cricket World Cup as well.
Is that
that's
football?
Cricket. No, it's cricket.
is that women?
No, it's men.
Oh.
It's men. As it should be, Helen. Yeah, men. Leather. Willow. The sound of the bat on the ball. You know.
What are you describing right now? Six runs. What's leather?
2 fingers in the air. Hello.
The ball leather.
What?
Is that what we're saying? What leather do they wear
in cricket? The ball is leather. The bat is willow.
Oh, God.
We should probably go.
We should
think.
We
I think this podcast
go.
Ended a while ago.
We should bring it. We should bring this to a natural end.
A merciful end.
Yeah. A merciful
Put it
end.
Down. Put it down now.
I will say before we go, there are a couple of specials to keep your eyes and ears peeled for. Our Rocket Man spoiler special with director Dexter Fletcher is available right now. Our X-Men Dark Phoenix spoiler special with writer-director Simon Kinberg and producer Hutch Parker will be up let's say Monday now, I'm guessing, probably more likely. Our Kevin Smith interview special will be up next week as well. But until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from my friend, my colleague, my boss, my leader, my I mean, what else? What else am I contractually obliged to call you, Terry Weitz? I don't know. But anyway, Terry Weitz, goodbye. It's goodbye from Terry White.
Goodbye, sweet Chris.
Pay rise?
Yeah, okay. Sure.
Yes! Legally binding. It is goodbye from Helen O'Hara. She's off to get some ass in a park or something like that. I'm not quite sure.
I'm going to the Bridge Theatre, actually. But yes,
the Bridge Theatre. Okay, all right. Bye-bye. And it's goodbye from James Dyer.
Protecting the Earth from the scum of the universe.
But not from terrible comedies.
Yeah.
Crucially, not from terrible comedies.
I'm sold now. I'm turned around. I'm all about the comedies now. Brilliant. Loving the lols.
Will they find their way into your personality at any point?
I resent that implication.
Anyway, and it's goodbye from me. I'm off to take down Tom Selleck. The key? The Tash. You take out the Tash, you take down the Selleck. The Tash controls the Selleck. If that doesn't work, I'll show him a Raiders of the Lost Ark poster, and when he's too busy crying about what might have been, I'll kick the fucker out of a window. You're defenestrated, Selleck. Take that. Thanks for listening. See you next week. I'm Bic Pentameter. Bye.